there's a note here on the run sheet that says the undiluted good vibes of Roglic and Thomas, and I would like this. One, I agree, but two, I want this explained by whoever put it down here. Welcome back to the Placeholders Podcast, everybody. I'm Kaylee Fretz. It is Wednesday, May 31st. The Giro wrapped up last weekend. The Dauphiné is coming up. We've got a whole bunch to talk. We're going to rate the Giro. That'll be fun. We might get some debate going, I think, on that one. We're also going to talk about the general good vibes of Primoz Roglic and Geraint Thomas. Geraint Thomas, known dude, apparently. We'll get into what exactly I'm talking about there in a little bit. Plus, some news. Pogacar's back on the road. Maybe we're going to see Primoz Roglic at the Tour de France. Unclear. And Ineos is flirting once again. Always flirting. Ineos is. We'll get into that later in the show. Joining me today, Dane Cash. How are you, Dane?
I'm doing great. I got to see you in person recently, Kaylee. And it's really great that I had that opportunity. It's been a while.
It's like 10 minutes, but you know, we'll take
it. It's good enough. Yeah, it's something.
It felt a bit chips in the night, to be perfectly honest, but I appreciated a good hug and a brief chat because we don't actually get to see each other in person all that often. So it was excellent.
Colorado's a big state. To those who don't know, you may live in the same state, but you don't live very close.
Yeah, like it's like most of Europe, basically. Actually, that's not really true. It's probably about the size of France, I think, Colorado. I don't know. I'm just winging it, but probably. Also joining me today, Johnny Long. How are you, Johnny?
I'm good. That's it. It's all to report. The sun is shining.
Back from the Ross.
Coming up. Yeah, I think it actually took me a while to recover, even though I wasn't really doing that much out there apart from driving. But it doesn't bode well for my tour legs. I'm gonna go to altitude. I'm gonna go to Alexandra Palace in London, which is slightly higher than the rest of it, just to get some altitude. Yeah,
just to prepare. Yeah. Maybe we can just find an intern out there to do the driving for us. I think that's really what we need. I'm not sure we could pull an internship program together in the next 3 weeks, but I think we should maybe try.
Oh, your brother was a good driver a couple years ago.
Yeah, that's true. I'll see if he's interested. Also joining me, Kit Nicholson. How are you, Kit?
I'm okay, thank you.
I had another person tell me recently that you were their favorite podcast person of all of the podcast people on the entirety of the Escape Collective podcast network. How do you feel about that?
I'm British, so I have no idea what to do with that. No, that's really nice to hear. I enjoy podcasting, so that's good.
I mean, the other one is my mother.
Thank
this
you
is a good
friend,
and the other one is my mother.
Okay, I feel like you're sort of like the BBC of the Escape Collective and the podcast network, just like a voice that sounds right and one you can trust, you know.
But Johnny, what does that make
Johnny,
you?
You're like, not helping you're the situation. You're British, mate. Yeah. Also, is being part being the BBC? I like that. I guess. I
mean, yeah. Just trustworthy state broadcasting.
State broadcasting. Cool.
What's Johnny then? Yeah, that's a good question. Dane, what is he in the US?
He's an internet radio show. being created out of his
Johnny's AM
garage.
Sports talk radio. Yeah.
Alex Jones.
Sirius XM, some sort of Sirius XM show for Johnny. I think that sounds about right. Yeah. All right, we have rambled for long enough. Before we get into today's show, I must remind you that Escape Collective is at the moment entirely funded off of memberships. That means that if you haven't signed up, it's bad news for the business as a whole. It's just, you know, I'm basically sitting here asking for you to head over to escapecollective.com, hit the little sign up button. We have monthly billing options now. That's a relatively new thing. Prior, it was all just annual billing. We now have a monthly option. Head over and do that if you haven't done it already. It's really, really important for the continued existence of this podcast, the continued existence of Wheel Talk and of Geek Warning and of Pretty Serious Bike Racing. It's everything for us, right? Like, this is the entire business. And I will remind you that this is a business. You know, we're paying the salaries of, what, 10 or so people. And we're doing it with your help. And so if you're not helping yet, this is my request that you please help out now. Well, thank you. Now let's get into today's show. So the first thing we're going to do today is we're going to rate the Giro. We have lots of Giro-related things we want to talk about. The last couple days of the race were phenomenal. They were fantastic. It was the most exciting time trial I've seen, I think since that Planche de Belfi time trial back in the day. But let's talk about the Giro as a whole. Our good friend Daniel Freib over at the Cycling Podcast, he rates the Giro, or he rates the Tour de France in red wine. I can't remember what he... Does he rate the Giro in Prosecco or something like that? I think
some
we
kind
can
of
probably...
Wine, for sure.
We can rate it in... Well, we mentioned it once already on this podcast. We'll rate it in Limoncello's out of 5. What do we think it was? The Giro's done the same thing last couple years, where the last couple days are fantastic. A lot of the rest of the race is less sort of day-to-day exciting. But where do we end up after 3 weeks?
I'll give the first one. Before the sort of final weekend, I'd have given it a 3 out of 5. But then because it was such a good ending, I would elevate it to 3.5. So it wasn't a bad race before that, I think. But people like highlighting the other narratives around, like, aside from the GC battle, like your Derek G's, your Ben Healy's, that's all great, but it's not the meat and potatoes of a Grand Tour. Like, the main thread through it all should be who's going to win the race. And while that ended really well, it was kind of not exciting at all, really. It was exciting for the wrong reasons, you know.
I'm kind of surprised that you started with 3.
That's what I was going to say. I was going to concur weekend. With your reasoning, but to me, it kind of went from being a 2.5 to a 3 or a 2 to a 3. It's ended up a 3 for me.
Okay.
For the same reasons, though. It was a little underwhelming. It wasn't super underwhelming because thanks to the Derek G's, they kept it from being too underwhelming. So it wasn't like it was a 0 or a 1. It just wasn't that great until the final weekend, which really helped, I think, salvage the entertainment factor for me.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of talk about, some fairly nasty sniping on the internet.
Sure.
About people calling it boring and it being an underwhelming race or whatever. I was scathing of it at times. And I think there's a very definite, you know, we were spoiled by the Tour de France last year, but we were also spoiled by the Giro. I remember writing a couple of articles at the other place about the innovative short stages, the stage Thomas de Gent won, and then that great GC day around Naples, or was that the other way around? But anyway, there were some really short, sharp, punchy stages that made us really go, oh, okay, this is what we can do. The stages don't have to be 200 kilometers long at this Grand Tour. But yeah, so I think in a very similar way to what the guys have said, there were lots of storylines to follow, especially with the standouts like Derek G and Ben Healy and Thibaut Pinot. But yeah, it was the final couple of days really sparked the race into action, which brought it up to a three for me, I think, as well. I would concur with Dane.
Up to a 3 is, I think, about as high as you can get with this particular one. It was 2.5 weeks of nothing much happening in the GC picture, right? So that's just, you know, that's the race for the actual winner, right? Stages are great, breakaways are great. Thank goodness for Derek G. Also, where the hell did he come from? And I'm fascinated to see what he does next. I think that'll be great. And his teammate Matthew Riccitello. I enjoyed watching what he was doing, because the last time I heard that name, it was when he was like 16, maybe, and he dropped both of my friends at the Tour of the Gila. as like a tiny, tiny child, and both of them were wondering who on earth this tiny, tiny child was. And it's good to see that, you know, he's got some real talent, and he is sort of coming good on that talent. I have to give it a 3. Honestly, it was like a 1.8 for me in the first week and a half. I don't find the breakaway narrative to be that sort of gripping. And 3 is pretty good. Like 3 is a, you know, 3 is where most Grand Tours end up. I think you're right, Kit, in that we've been a bit spoiled in the last like 18 months, basically post COVID. We've been a bit spoiled by these Grand Tours where every single day, and the riders tell us this too, every single day feels like it's the last day of the race and that they're just chucking everything at it, right? And for whatever reason, maybe it was how difficult that last week was, they didn't do that this year. Maybe it was the fact that we lost a couple of the key favorites, like guys like Theo Gegenhardt, but they didn't do that this year. And as a result, I don't think you can give it much more than 3, unfortunately.
I think that the loss of the big favorites is a big part of that. I mean, it wasn't really through the fault of the riders entirely that the race was what it was. It didn't help that COVID struck and that a crash took Gegenhardt out of the race. Who knows how it would have been in terms of excitement with them in the race. And even regardless of whether they raced in an exciting way, it would have been cool to see all of the top riders there. And that was just a bummer. That was just, it is what it is. It's cycling.
Yeah, big bummer. But it is, there have been a number of races in the past few years where sometimes the winner is lumbered with an asterisk, at least in some people's minds. But we've got to, you know, even before COVID, you'd never get to the end of a Grand Tour and have all the favourites still in the race. Crashing and illness is part of cycling, just like it's part of, I don't know, riding a bike to the shops. I think that Roglic, you know, his win, even though it would have been, I think it would have been a more exciting race had Evenepoel stuck around, and I think Theo was coming into some amazing form, but I don't think, although that was, you know, it was a bit of a cloud over the race, especially in the middle, but I think the outcome of it wasn't too badly affected and as a whole.
I said, do you think there's an asterisk next to Roglic's name here?
I don't think so at all. I thought he was going to win the thing anyway. I think seeing Theo Gegenhardt race, when we did see them in action, I think he mid race I'd have told you Theo Gegenhardt's going to win it. But before, I thought there was a pretty damn good chance that it was going to be Roglic.
I agree. I don't think there's an asterisk. I mean, Kit, myself, Matt Deneef, we picked Primoz Roglic to win, and he won the race. I mean, it is what it is. I think it's a bummer, but that's all. It's not. There's no asterisk. I reserve asterisks for far more serious infractions, let's say. Yeah.
I think I would reserve them for races in which top GC favorites never even start. Right?
Yeah.
If you start and you can't finish for some, you know, whatever the reason, whether it's crashing or illness or whatever, like that is part of bike racing and that is not an asterisk situation, right? It's only if you started the race and there really wasn't anybody in that sort of top tier of GC favorites to begin with. I think that's the only time you can maybe kind of make that argument, and I still don't really like that argument even when that's the case. Let's go to this last day. Penultimate day. The day into Rome was not particularly exciting. The final time trial.
Wait, real quick. This is the second time Johnny has seemed to express distaste with the word penultimate, and I want to know why. What's your problem? He shook his head
from
there.
Last year.
He shook his head there.
We at the old place, we put it in sort of the cliche bucket, and I'm not really sure why we're calling it. There's not really another good word for it.
Yeah, that's. I definitely made this exact point on a podcast when I'd missed the original conversation. So, and so, what do you say instead of penultimate? It's a word.
I don't know.
It's just a word.
Second to last. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's more words.
I think we were so what we were doing is we were essentially putting, it was like a swear jar where if we used a cliche, you know, taking it day by day or whatever. I can't remember why penultimate ended up in the swear jar.
It's just a word that you hear all the time, and I think like everyone uses it. So maybe just in terms of pure differentiation, just chopping it about a bit. It's like everyone using the word like chapeau. It's just like.
Let's what about the? What about is? How do you feel about those
words,
Johnny?
I'm on.
Can you use those?
I mean, we could. Look, give me. Give me a week and I'll get back to you with alternatives.
All right.
I think sensations is a bad cycling cliche. Yeah. I think winningest is a bad cycling cliche. Yeah.
I can't agree on the second
Americans
one.
For that one.
Some of my favorite cycling cliches are English versions of words that we don't actually use in English. Mm. So like sensations is actually kind of in that category where like no one uses sensations in that way in the English language, but you use it that way in French. And so that's, it sort of like made its way backwards into English in that way. And yeah, they become a bit cliche. Anyway,
sorry,
we got sidetracked. We got sidetracked here a little bit. I want to go to stage 20, you know, the final time trial. There's a note here on the run sheet that says the undiluted good vibes of Roglic and Thomas. And I would like this, one, I agree, but two, I want this explained by whoever put it down here.
I put it down. It was the stage 20 time trial, but then just sort of the aftermath of winning and losing and how they both took it. Predominantly Geraint Thomas, who already at last year's tour, you could sense that he knows that the end is near for his career. And I think even the fact that he was up there at this Giro, he'll probably look back on and say, you know, wow, I can't believe I was able to do that. But the fact that he got so close to winning his second Grand Tour and then didn't on such a... It's so hard when it's a stage like that, I think, to lose rather than like a road stage. I don't know why. It's just my immediate thought. But he was such a gracious loser, sort of... the same as Roglic after that 2020 tour loss. And yeah, just seeing them both afterwards with like their kids about and the sort of the hugs exchanged and just the general vibe was, I felt good. And it was the complete antidote to any sort of the grumblings about the Giro before. It's sort of like after all the rain and misery, it sort of erupted into this sort of sunshine, bike racing, everyone's fine with whatever happens type thing. I don't know.
I think that's a function of age, or maybe not age, but just sort of like where they are in their careers, probably.
Yeah, and like I think even Roglic, and he's a bit younger, I think he's sort of had sort of thoughts about how much longer he's gonna carry on. And you know, they've both got young families. They both won enough to sort of have defined their careers, and I think you also just realize that sometimes you just can't win, and there's no point sort of raging against the universe about that fact. And it's better to just, yeah, I don't know, be grateful for what you have. I don't know why I've suddenly got so positive and like rating the Giro 3.5 and talking like this. Clearly, something's happened. But
I like this, Johnny. Yeah.
Nah, he worries me. Anyway,
positive, happy Johnny. No, I think it's very valid. I mean, we haven't seen even just like. Geraint Thomas's post on Instagram afterward was so magnanimous, and it's not something we see all that often. You know, you often see sort of like a cursory handshake, a congratulations, but you know, this is like sort of an in-depth post about how, you know, Roglic fully deserved it, and he's absolutely gutted, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, that's bike racing. It was just a very mature response, I think, from both of them, and perhaps. You know, it's a result of both of them having won many things before, and two, yeah, kind of just been there, done that. Like, they don't have a whole lot left to prove, either of them. It would be, you got the sense that for Geraint Thomas, it was more like a personal quest, as opposed to so like internal motivation, right? As opposed to, I feel like a lot of the younger riders, there's a fair amount of external motivation. There's a lot of pressure piled on them. There's a lot of, you know, fans and family and team demanding a lot of them. And if they fail, that pressure probably makes such a magnanimous response almost impossible. But you've got two riders here for whom all of the pressure was essentially internal. And I think that that's a big part of the reason why we saw undiluted good vibes from both of them, despite it being just such a close finish, and one that unfortunately for Geraint Thomas went the wrong way.
Yeah, I think I thought a lot about the Tour de France this weekend, just gone, and Geraint Thomas's, you know, he almost explicitly said to the media that he was proving to his team that he's still there. Because he won the Tour de Suisse on the way in, but that may have an asterisk to some people because that I think half of that peloton went home for COVID, including and well anyway, Thomas got the jersey off somebody's back in a similar way to this year, yeah, he was not expected to land on the podium. He was there as a support rider or a protected support rider, whereas this year he was there as a co-leader. And it was completely justified. And yeah, I think everything you guys have said about his, you know, him with his kid in that great interview where he was explaining what a selfie stick is to his son, Max. It was just so relaxed. You know, it was the same vibes as a summer barbecue party or something. It was so chilled. And it was the same with Roglic. There was great footage of him screaming in, well, I don't know how much it was delight and how much it was relief when he knew that he'd won. Because I think Roglic did have something to prove. You know, he's now playing second fiddle to Vingegaard at Jumbo-Visma. But he's very clearly a very capable, more than very capable. That's a very dilute word for what he is. He's one of the best Grand Tour racers in the world. You know, he got better. He peaked on stage 20. And I mean, as a hobby cyclist, just racing that intensely or riding that intensely for 3 weeks and being your best on the 20th day is insane.
I just raced 2 days in a row, and on Monday I was useless.
Yeah, there we go.
Day three. Completely useless.
It's sort of strange to me that there was even any kind of, I don't know, conversation around Roglic's ability to close out a Grand Tour, considering he has done it over and over and over again at the Vuelta. And it's like, we watch it at the Vuelta, and it's awesome, and it's like fun to watch the Vuelta every year, and then people always forget about the Vuelta within a few months. So I don't think it's that fair to him that conversation was going on, but at the end of the day, it was. I mean, that was the conversation. The conversation was around, oh, final time trial, you never know what's going to happen. Because of the one time back in the Tour de France, which, you know, is a career-defining moment for him, obviously. But he there was that conversation around him, and I think he did have that to prove. And he did, he proved
it. Yeah, and the Vuelta's always come after a failed attempt at something else, Neil, I think. Maybe not for his first Vuelta, which was 2019, the year before the tour. He came here to win the bloody thing, and he didn't have any, I don't know, he didn't have, well, he did have demons to exercise, but it was very much, this was his goal for the season. What I also like about Roglic as a racer is that he always has a bad day. And so he really is a case study of what a GC cyclist is. You know, on Tuesday when Joao Almeida won the stage and Roglic lost 30 seconds and people were writing him off, it's like, nah, don't count your chickens. This guy does this.
Also, he taught his son how to do the like ski jump podium celebration. So like, you don't do that unless you're feeling confident, do you?
I'd like Amazing. To think that he did that recently. It would be a real bummer if he taught his son that a long time ago and hasn't had a chance to use it until now.
I mean, the son's not particularly old, so can't have taught
right,
it to
okay, there's a limit on the, yeah.
Like, the son looks like he's, what, probably four or something like that? So, you know, probably could have only taught that in the last 18 months and had it actually stick.
Do you think also, just quickly on Thomas and Roglic, I think part of their sort of good vibes is that they're both slightly shocked that they managed to get to the end of a race where so many unlucky things happened to everyone else, that they are the two that didn't get touched by any misfortune.
Especially when that has been a problem for both of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's probably an element of that. Like I said, I just saw relief from both of them almost, even from Geraint Thomas in some respects, right? And maybe that was the most shocking thing of all, is that, yeah, you got the sense that he's not going to sit on this second place and just like rue the day for the rest of his life. Like, I think he's going to be pretty, particularly 6 months from now, I think he'll be pretty proud of that ride. So.
He also is not a rider. Roglic is a rider who has, you know, racked up the podium performances. It helps when you win the Grand Tour three times like he did at the Vuelta. But Roglic has quite a solid history already of podium performances. And Thomas, although he had finished, obviously, first at the Tour de France, he only had two other you know, career Grand Tour podiums only. Okay, yeah. But for him, I think a second place is great. I mean, that's a big result to be proud of. And I think for Roglic, a second place would have been just another one, you know, another near miss. Whereas for Geraint Thomas, I think there is a bit more to be proud of, or a bit more to be happy about with a second place than would have been the case for Roglic.
I agree with that. Here's a question for y'all. Is there like a more pure moment of, maybe pure isn't the right word, of sporting excitement, like pure sports, than the moment that Roglic dropped his chain in that time trial? Like the weight of 3 weeks is on this little like dip that I'm still not even really clear on how this happened. He's running a one by, presumably with a chain watcher. I believe I saw that. I still have no real clue how that happened, but it did. And it just created this moment where I feel like the entirety of cycling fandom all gasped at the same time. And that's not something that happens all that often. That was actually, particularly because he ended up winning, I think that was kind of a special moment in this race. Like it almost like pulled fandom together in some ways.
Yeah, I was watching the time trial around my friend's house, and I was watching on my phone, and then we had the championship playoff final, which is like how the final team gets promoted to the Premier League on like the big TV. And he'd like gone to the kitchen, and I audibly gasped when Roglic's mechanical happened, and he immediately assumed that it was something in the football, and I was like, nah, you've got to come see this is crazy. And like, it's one of those those racing moments where, like, there's probably 2 or 3 per season where you audibly gasp at something you're watching, especially if you watch a lot of racing, and it was one of those. And then it was immediately like you wrote him off. You're like, I can't, you know, you can't believe it. And then when those time checks were coming in, and like when you're even watching like the cadence of both riders, it was like, this surely not. But it was unreal. And I think that without that moment, the whole weekend is not as elevated as it was. I think the fact that that is part of the story is huge. And even like the things come out with how the guy who wasn't the Jumbo Visma jersey motorbike guy, which is also just an insane look. The guy at the side of the road who pushed him back on was his former ski jump teammate or something from his last competition before he turned cycling full time. It's just nuts.
Which was at the same venue, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. Like, the script writers have done unreal.
I thought that moment was, and because he won, if he hadn't won, it would have been a devastating moment.
It would have been crushing, yeah.
Yeah, but I think because he did win, I think it was actually one of the best moments of the race. Like, the amount of emotion that I assume came out of everybody watching in that moment, and then the fact that he went on to win made it just that much more amazing.
I mean, it was the moment of the race for me.
The only moment when they're not pedaling.
Yeah. That's how sports works.
Yeah.
Sometimes weird stuff happens.
I love that Primoz Roglic managed to win a bike race despite the most extreme bad luck. It's so him.
I would venture to say that it may not be bad luck though.
Wasn't it a pothole? He just went over a pothole in the road.
Well, that's unlucky, isn't it?
I don't know.
He's got eyes, right? He could have seen it and avoided it.
But it was right the way across the road. Everyone had to avoid it.
Oh, really?
It was just him
I mountain bike over much larger holes on a regular basis, and my chain doesn't fall off. it shouldn't. Something weird happen. You know, at least people are pointing the finger at SRAM, right? Which is a bit silly. I'm pretty sure there's a clutch in the derailleur he was running. He's running a single chain ring with a. Like I said, there's no like rational reason for that chain to fall off. Clearly, something weird happened, but. Yeah, I mean, I think you kind of have to put it down to just some weird freak thing. It's yeah, and he rode through it. So anyway, I just thought it was worth pulling apart that moment a little bit, because it was, like I said, for me, it was the moment of the Giro. I know it wasn't some stinging attack, it wasn't anything like that, but it coalesced all of the emotions of those last couple days into this like single 5 second point. And that's not something we always get, you know, out of every bike race. I would actually say that it's probably a strong contender for moment of the year, depending on obviously what happens the rest of the season. But like it's I haven't had a moment watching a bike race like that in quite some time where you're just sort of shock stunned. Like, I you know, I'm not cheering for either one of them, but you don't want to see someone lose the race like that. So a little bit deflated. And then to sort of like reinflate over the next 10 minutes. Yeah, it was exceptional.
Yeah, it was made even better by just the insane crowds of Slovenians. I think one of the, you know, you see that happen to Roglic and you know that in a minute, 2 minutes, he's going to emerge into this massive, I don't know, storm of noise. It must have been an incredible day to be there in any capacity, riding or otherwise. Might have been quite hard to hear the time checks that you're getting in your ear. But watching the first wave of riders go off and just enjoying themselves on this ridiculously cruel climb. That must have made, well, probably helped Roglic a lot as well. In those, how many of those 14 seconds are thanks to, well, the population of Slovenia?
A lot of them.
Yeah.
Let's move on from the Giro. We've chatted Giro long enough, but I do want to stay on Roglic though. So sort of question marks around him going to the Tour now. I mean, I can't imagine he'd go to the Tour, you know, as team leader. That's probably not going to happen, but let's not forget that Jumbo-Visma did have to kind of pull some folks into the Giro last minute. Like Sepp Kuss was definitely slated to start the Tour de France and got pulled in because they had, you know, injuries and illness. I wonder if they'll, you know, they might use some of those really strong riders from the Giro, mostly Roglic and Sepp, and apply them to the Tour de France again. Do we have any notion as to whether that's going to happen?
No, the only thing that people are going off is that Roglic answered the question of whether he's going to the Tour cryptically. But you got to think about how Jumbo managed to win the Tour last year, and that was by using Roglic. And there was a really good tweet from GCN stats guy, Killian Kelly, saying that he does it every year with whoever wins the Giro, saying they've got to go to the Tour to, just in case there's a chance of them doing the Giro Tour double, which I think is just really fun and a really good point. I don't know, it depends how he recovers from the Giro and all that, but yeah, like surely take him, right? Just think, like,
it's interesting how I feel like mindsets have shifted a little bit, because 5 years ago you wouldn't bat an eyelid at a rider doing the Giro Tour double in a season, not necessarily to try and win it, but yeah, you also had that. And I don't think, well, I don't know. We've seen Roglic go to the Tour and not get what he wanted and then go and win the Vuelta. We know he can do back-to-back Grand Tours, even if he does lose out in the last few days of one. So I think there's no reason to believe that he won't because he did the Vuelta. It depends on what the team decides that all their different targets are going to be, what he wants to do, how much time he wants drinking beers with Geraint Thomas and their kids.
Well, quickly on the beers, there was an it was on his own Geraint's own podcast where he said he only managed half a beer after the Giro because his stomach was so upset from all the gels he needed in the last week. So that shows just how hard it was, because he had so many beers after the Tour he won. But with Roglic at the Tour, you've got to think also that Vingegaard is going to go there as defending champion. There's going to be so much attention and pressure on him. So you bring Roglic along and he's kind of like a semi-distraction from all that. And, you know, maybe you get him like doing his... He's got a newfound like media thing where he kind of likes to have a little bit of fun sometimes. So maybe he goes in and does like a Simon Yates-esque, you know, I'm going to win. I'm the favorite.
I think the risk there is though that you create a lot of potential tension and controversy that maybe Jonas Vingegaard doesn't want if you do that. Yeah, it's a distraction, but maybe in a bad way.
No, because I think surely like they go in there knowing that Vingegaard's the only guy that's been hogging the Tour, and in the knowledge that Roglic has just ridden a Giro. And then it ends up being like last year where Roglic like has his chance and works, and they work together on the climb they select and try and crack him. Maybe it happens again. Maybe Vingegaard falls off or gets sick the first week, and then it switches to Roglic. Like, surely it's a thing worth guessing. Or they go with Wout van Aert, who's going to win three stages in a time trial sprint and mountain again. Who knows?
I also, I mean, re-inter-intra-team tension. I don't think Vingegaard was programmed with a bad bone in his body, so I don't think he'll mind if Roglic is there to distract the media.
Yeah, if anything happens, he just has to call up his wife, and then she'll like sort of they'll figure it out. Like, there's no how can there be any intra-team tension if you're always on the phone to your family? It's just impossible.
We mentioned Pogacar there for a moment. There is some news around him. He is back on the road. Presumably he's been training indoors for a little while, but he's fully back on a road bike with a cast on his wrist. 4 weeks out, right? That's enough, maybe.
Yeah, this isn't a comment on his racing, but he posted on Instagram a week or so ago saying he's been doing lots of work in his garden and kitchen, which I took to mean he was doing lots of gardening and cooking, when in actual fact, in the photos with the caption, he was doing core in the garden and and indoor training in the kitchen.
I guess that's not that surprising, given, you know, his job. But
yeah,
I mean,
I just love the idea of Pogacar on his knees with his hands in mud. I just
from a timing perspective, it was not great timing to get off the bike for a while. Granted, he was going to take a small break, but certainly not a break to the same extent that he ended up taking. But 4 weeks should be enough to turn. It's not like he, you know. Okay, let's say he was at 100% for Liège. It's not like he dropped to 50, right? He dropped to 92, and he needs to work his way back up. And I think we're gonna see a pretty fit Tadej Pogacar at this Tour de France. And I think that he's had plenty of time, and sort of the advent of, you know, Zwifting and indoor training becoming sort of a real part of pros' lives, which it did during the pandemic. I think that, yeah, these issues are not as sort of season altering as they once were.
Yeah, and like last year, he literally told Jumbo-Visma on a podcast how to beat him. So if he doesn't do that this year, then I reckon he stands a pretty good chance. And did you see that? Did you see that chocolate eclair he was eating on his Instagram story the other day? It looks so delicious that I think it somehow only increases his chances.
Is that head games he's playing?
Yeah,
because Jonas Vingegaard hasn't had a chocolate eclair in like 4 years, yeah. Right? And probably really wants one, and watches that video.
I think he's got to be head games. Know what one looks like, to be honest.
Poor Vingegaard, getting some stick.
Next on our little list of news here, this is a fun one. Ineos is apparently flirting with Remco Evenepoel. And Patrick Lefebvre has said, stop flirting with my Remco. Unfortunately for Patrick Lefebvre, he cannot stop Ineos from flirting with all of their money and all of the things that they could do to potentially bring Remco Evenepoel over. Now, the question for me here is actually something, Kit, I think you mentioned this in our Slack, as to why doesn't Ineos, they have quite a bit of young talent that they don't clearly really want to back if they're looking at then stealing Remco Evenepoel from Quickstep. Why? Like, what is it? Just they need to win the Tour de France? You know, Jim Ratcliffe is like, you guys got to win the Tour de France. And so they essentially have to just go try to buy whoever can do that for them. Is that where we're at right now?
I think it's got to be. I mean, yeah, it's a reflection on their shift in mindset. I think it seems like, and it's something that has been becoming more evident in the past couple of years, is Ineos's, I don't know, short attention span or desire for immediate gratification that is, I think, fairly new for them. Obviously, all teams want to win every bike race, especially Ineos. But if you compare it to how, when they came into the sport, their goal was to have a British rider win the Tour de France within 5 years. That was their kind of, we're building a platform here. And then if you look at people like Jonas Vingegaard or Tadej Pogacar, they were developed quite quickly, it's true, but they were developed by their teams and they've been with the same outfits for a while. And I think, you know, multiple Grand Tour winners, this is not proven by hard facts, but I think multiple Grand Tour winners probably are better served by a bit of longevity, a bit of consistency, loyalty. And, you know, Ineos, they're recruiting in the past couple of years. They have got some good older statesmen, proven winners. But last year, they've got a couple of 20-year-olds, Josh Tarling, Ben Tullett, all these little whippersnappers who will be vying for Geraint Thomas's spot on the bus in the next couple of years. And frankly, that's the other issue with this immediate gratification element and development is Evenepoel, although I think he will get to the point that he needs to be to compete at races like Tour de France, even this Giro d'Italia, I think he's got a couple of years before he's ready to win a Tour de France against Pogacar and Vingegaard without bad luck befalling the others. So it just makes me a little bit, make me think a little bit that Ineos needs to have a think and just look at what they've got going on and actually, just try to be less petty and throwing money around because it's not helping.
I would suggest that in this case, I have a hard time blaming the Ineos Grenadiers too much because they had a plan for the future. They had a foundation in place with a rider that we all thought was going to be the rider of the moment. And then he crashed into a bus. I mean, they had to rebuild. They had to find an alternative when 3 years ago, it seemed like, or 4 years ago, it seemed like they had that in the bag. They had the future settled. And then all of a sudden, with Egan Bernal's crash, we never know what is going to, the future is going to hold for him. We don't know what the future will hold for him. So I think they kind of had to scramble and find, or have to continue to scramble and potentially throw their money at people.
Yeah, I still think the whole Ineos Evenepoel thing is just like a bit icky. Like it's a real sort of billionaire sickness where just like your answers are like buying things. And I think, say it ended up that Evenepoel goes to Ineos and wins the tour, I think it's still just a bit like, well...
Well done, Patrick.
There's just like there's less heart in it, And I think, you see it with like guys like Jeff Bezos and stuff, how he, there's more money than whatever, but you still can't like buy any class. Like he's like getting like six packs injected and like wearing like dumb sunglasses and like his house is gross. Like you can't just buy that sort of that je ne sais quoi that is attached to things with real meaning, like the Geraint Roglic Giro weekend. Like that, Jim Ratcliffe can't buy that as much as he might want to. Like these are real tangible things. It's probably good that that's the case. But yeah, I don't know if it's just like everyone like sort of whipping it up and like, oh, he's going to go whatever, but it does seem like maybe it's a thing that could happen. I don't know. Makes sense.
I think it's worth mentioning too, that this is it is a shift for Ineos in that they're Wiggins and Thomas both were essentially like created, right? And Froome kind of created, right? Like they were not the Tadej Pogacar of their era, right? Like they were not 21-year-old, you are the best bike racer in the world and no one is questioning it. They were, Froome was what, 27, 28? They made these riders into what they were. They found riders who they thought had the sort of essentially the right number of watts. They leaned them down. They took years to do so. Like they made Grand Tour winners out of track racers, right? Like two of the three were track racers. And I think that as a result, like when you do that, and this is basically what you guys are talking about, when you do that, it feels like you earned it, right? As opposed to just going and buying the latest and greatest. And the thing is, we also know that they know how to do this. Granted, Dave Brailsford is preoccupied probably with Manchester United at this point, or whatever, Nice, whatever else he's doing at this moment. But there's the infrastructure of that team is still there. And, who in their roster is the next Geraint Thomas, right? Who is a phenomenal rider and just two dudes cruising by on riding lawnmowers. There we go. I don't know if you can hear that. who in the roster is the next Wiggins or the next Froome or the next Geraint Thomas, who spent a sizable portion of their career being very good, but not necessarily very good at the Tour de France. And actually, Froome wasn't very good at all. but Wiggins and Geraint Thomas were. Who is that for them? And why aren't they looking that direction?
I think Tom Pidcock is a potential. I'm of two minds because I'm not sure of his consistency and endurance over 3 weeks yet. But maybe they should be, if they want to spend some money, they should spend it on Derek G, because he is a track rider who can ride up hills quite well. And something that he proved to himself and to the rest of the world is that he can ride a grand tour and he can stick it out. I mean, two breakaways in the last two mountain stages of a three-week race. You've never done a race that long before in your first full season as a professional cyclist.
He also has the same monarch as most of the rest of the team.
This is very true.
So that could bring them together.
Yeah. And he's called G.
He also probably did more work, you know, like kilojoules, than anybody else in that Giro, right? But that seriously, I mean, the front GC guys spend most of their Giro just doing as little as they possibly can, and then they have slightly superior, you know, watts per kilo in the 20 minutes that really matter. But Derek G was in how many breakaways?
He spent a third of the race.
Yeah.
In breakaways.
It's an insane workload. And so if he can do that and continue to get into breakaways, which is not easy, let's keep in mind, then yeah, I mean, he could do some amazing things, I think.
I feel like I'm constantly in the position of defending the Ineos Grenadiers, which I don't like being in that position, but it's the position I find myself in when I podcast with Kaylee and Johnny, I think. Kit, you seem like
I think Johnny hates him more than I do.
Maybe so. But so somebody has to say these things. At least Kit seems pretty neutral to me. So here I am. I'm going to say this. The same thing I basically said about Bernal. Kaylee, to go back to your question about who's going to be the next Thomas, that rider may have gone on to win the Giro, but he broke his hip. That rider could have been Theo Gegenhardt, and maybe he still is, but it's just another reason why I think the team is going to throw their money at whoever they can. You don't know who's going to turn into the next Geraint Thomas and who's going to crash into a bus or break their hip in a crash at a bike race. I mean, that happens. I have a hard time blaming them for trying to find alternatives when, you know, options one and maybe option two, just things happen to them.
The thing with Remco, though, is that proposition is buying a finished product,
right,
or at least,
right.
I definitely take your point. And Theo is a very good, I think, you know, last year was a difficult year for him. He's clearly, you know, he's going to be competing for Grand Tours for a good few years.
It's a shame that you spoke about the Ineos hatred, which I disagree with. I'd say it's criticism, but I'm gonna deal in facts here and put on my capital J journalist hat and say that, you know, since those tour wins, we've had the whole sort of British government ethics committee fallout where there was the laptops going missing and the Team Sky Ineos doctors all sorts of stuff going on there, which take a long time to fully explain, but everyone probably knows already. So, I mean, if we want to talk about asterisks and racing and Grand Tour victories, I mean, and we haven't had Brailsford address any of that still, which is something I'll keep bringing up until he does. Because that is a good point as well, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, the Jiffy bag came around the same time as we managed to turn a bunch of track riders into Grand Tour winners.
Like, it's not a nice, and it's kind of a thing that you say and you're like, oh God, I'm going to get in trouble for this. But it does bear saying, especially when you had Vingegaard at the end of last year's tour come out and just say point blank that he's clean, which is, you know, that's
well, it's just never been addressed.
Yeah. Whereas they won't address it.
Yeah. It's never been adequately addressed. It's never been explained. It's just been obfuscated for a long time. And I think at this point, like, we almost forget about it, right? Because all this stuff happened now close to 10 years ago, or more than 10 years ago. And it is worth keeping in mind when you're talking about the general trajectory of Ineos. Right?
Sorry to bring the vibe down.
And we should we point out we're not necessarily blaming Geraint Thomas?
Yeah, particularly not the younger guys. Or, you know,
yeah, right, yeah, it's just now, it's a political thing. Yeah.
My thought to that, Johnny, would be I agree completely. Also, the Sanyaol Duval management remains in cycling, and Rabobank won the Tour de France last year. So, I guess.
Yeah. It's cycling. There's always going to be that undertone, yeah, isn't there?
Sadly. That's why I'm looking forward to Lidl coming in, taking over the Trek Segafredo team, and hopefully they don't mess up the kits, and then, like, how, like...
Grocery stores, yeah, we talked about this before, but they seem so wholesome.
Kit's looking very confused because that was a bit of a tangent thing, but I just thought
I'm still trying to find some positivity
and just like, you know what, any darkness doesn't matter
because there are vegetables in the world.
We're gonna have Toms and other people just like posing with big baskets of groceries.
This is true.
That's
this is always fun. Do a supermarket sweep on rest days.
Yeah.
Let's leave pro cycling behind. That's actually really all we have to chat about today. But I did want to shout out before we close up. Campagnolo has a new drivetrain and the thumb shifter is gone. This is something we've talked about a little bit on Geek Warning before, and Ronan has talked about it a bunch, and Ronan wrote a story about this. It's up on the site right now. That's excellent. Go read the story, and also make sure you check out this week's Geek Warning if you do want a deeper dive into that Campagnolo stuff. Also, coming this week, Dane, you're going to be previewing the Dauphiné, which is looking like a super strong lineup, and you know the Dauphiné always has... well, a sizable impact on the Tour de France.
Yeah, I think we're going to get a good Dauphiné this year. Vingegaard will be there. Preview is a tricky word to say because technically we're going to be recording like after the first stage. So it'll be more like a mid-view. But we're going to talk about the Dauphiné. Just there. That's the general vibe. So tune in to the Pretty Serious Bike Racing podcast this week.
And as always, all of those are available on the sort of main Escape Collective podcast channel. You can also find them all on their own channel. If you only want Geek Warning, or you only want Placeholders, you only want Pretty Serious Bike Racing, or you only want Wheel Talk, they all have their own channel as well. Now, last thing, go sign up. I'm going to just take a pause, open up your phone, Chrome, Safari, whatever browser you prefer. Just go do it. EscapeCollective.com. It's how we keep this whole thing running. So if you haven't done it yet, please go do so. If you're a regular listener, really please go do so. And we'll love you for it. You get all sorts of great... you get access to our private Discord. You get to comment on the site. You get no paywall on the site. You get all sorts of good stuff. Plus, you get to keep hearing us in your ears every single week. Otherwise, we will disappear into the ether. All right.
EscapeCollective.com/join. Takes you directly there.
There you go.
One fewer click if you just go straight to /join. So
there you go.
Making it easy.
/join. All right. Thanks, Dane. Thanks, Johnny. Thanks, Kit. We'll be back next week with another episode of the Placeholders. Bye, everybody.